welcome to Comic Talk Today for Tuesday, November 27, 2018. This is the Top of the Pile. So, of course, Top of the Pile, I talk about some of my favorite books from the past week. And you're thinking to yourself, Martin, you haven't done the Top of the Pile in like 2 weeks. Yes, you are correct. In fact, I was going to post some of my catch-up episodes this weekend, and I totally forgot. So, my bad. Those will be out. I haven't decided yet. You know what? There might be one out later on today. I don't know. They're already recorded. I don't like to do two episodes in one day, but maybe I'll do that just to get caught up. If not, they'll be out at the end of the week. Anyways, this is Top of the Pile for last week. So this is for books that came out on November 21st. And of course, tomorrow is a brand new comic book day. So there's going to be some more books to talk about, I guess, tomorrow. But without further ado, let's talk about some of the stuff from last week. And I gotta say, last week was kind of a weird week. And I know that if you're in the U.S., it was Thanksgiving on Thursday. So, I don't know, maybe that impacted comic book scheduling somehow. I'm not sure, but I found that the books that I was most drawn to last week were books that I don't know if I would normally be entirely drawn to, but, you know, now that I look at the list, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're exactly the kind of books that I'm drawn to. There's five books that I want to talk about, of course. We've got, one Vertigo, one Marvel, two Image, and one Dynamite. And, let's start off with Dynamite, because, I want to talk about Mars Attacks, number two. This is written by Kyle Starks, with art by Chris Schweizer, colors by, I'm assuming, his wife, Liz Schweizer, and a ton of great covers, by the way. I'm not going to list the cover artists for this, but there's something about Mars Attacks, right? It's got that, like, 50s, 60s sci-fi vibe to it. And so, of course, the covers really embody that time period. And, you know, if you're a fan of sci-fi films, you know that the 50s were, I would say maybe the golden age of alien sci-fi flicks. And they don't have some of the best sci-fi flicks, but they had the most sci-fi flicks and some of the craziest sci-fi stories. And so, of course, Mars Attacks definitely fits into that. If you're familiar with the creative team, then you might understand why I enjoy this book. But if you're not, go read Rock Candy Mountain. It's a story, I think it was put out by Image. It was a miniseries by the same creative team, Kyle Starks and Chris Schweizer. I believe the roles were swapped in that book, so Chris wrote it and Kyle drew it. And it's about hobo culture in the United States, and it's freaking fascinating. Because if you ever look up hobo culture, like hobo language and hobo code, it's absolutely brilliant. Those of you that have read, for example, Valiant Comics, Archer and Armstrong, the first series that came out when they launched the Fred Van Lente run, you may be familiar with some of the hobo culture stuff. What was the book that The Delinquents? It was a crossover between Archer and Armstrong and Quantum and Woody. Hobo culture plays a large role in that particular book, and that book is beautiful to look at. That's great, great art in that book. Anyways, we're not talking about that. We're talking about Mars Attacks number two. And I think I may have talked about the first issue. If not, I definitely mentioned that I was going to be picking it up. And I just want to talk about it briefly because I think it's really interesting. I think this is a book that maybe a lot of people are going to be sleeping on. They're not going to be picking up this book either because they don't care for Mars Attacks or they don't read Dynamite or whatever it might be. But I gotta tell you, even if you are not familiar with the Mars Attacks franchise, I think you'll really enjoy this book. Because at its core, this book is about a father-son relationship. Of course, seen through the eyes of this crazy, I guess, apocalypse as the Martians come to Earth and start destroying everything. But the cool thing about Mars Attacks is that it's really funny and it's extremely self-aware. And I think that's really important in a type of book like this. In particular with the Mars Attacks franchise. I think that's kind of always been the case, right? Even through the films and the various comic book iterations. But this book is really funny and it really leans on it in order to say something about the world that we live in. And I know now some of you are probably turning off. They're like, ah, I don't care about the world that we live in. I read my comics to escape reality. Well, yeah, you're right. And you should read Mars Attacks for that exact reason. Because this is very much escapism, and I absolutely adore it. The art style, I think, is very different from the majority of comics on the shelf. If you are a fan of, let's say, like, big two superhero books, you just want, like, really defined, like, awesome art, then you're not going to get that here. But I gotta tell you, Chris Schweizer's art is just absolutely brilliant. Because of his cartoony nature, and I use the word cartoony kind of loosely, it really fits with the theme of what's going on, right? And with the humor of the book, and it serves great to follow the comedic timing of the writing of the book. And yes, it's a little cartoony, it's very loose, it almost looks like maybe it would fit very well in a newspaper strip, and I think that makes sense as well because of what Mars Attacks really is about, ultimately. And so I love it. I absolutely love it. Of course, there's tons of humor in here, as we saw at the end of the first issue. If you haven't read it, pick it up. I recommend it. You're not going to be disappointed. Pick the series up. Or at least, put it on your trade list for whenever the trade comes out. I think it's a 4-issue miniseries. But, at the end of the first issue, we had our main character. He rescued his dad from this alien invasion in the town they were in, and they don't have a getaway vehicle, so of course he puts his dad in a wheelbarrow, and basically he's running around the countryside escaping aliens with his dad in a wheelbarrow. And in this issue, they come upon a town as they're escaping, and the town is full of, we'll say rednecks. Can I say that? Is that politically correct? I don't know, whatever. We don't care about political correctness here. So, they come up on a town full of rednecks, and, of course, there's some commentary on here about gun control and, the right to bear arms, which, of course, is very important for a lot of folks here in the United States. And, these guys are, you know, the ultimate hillbilly, we'll just say. And, of course, I live in South Carolina, so I'm very familiar with, this type of personality. And so I found it really hilarious to see it here, right? So they've barricaded themselves on this town. They've got, you know, their pickup trucks blocking the main road, coming in and out. And, the group sees this dad and son duo coming in. They're like, oh, we have new recruits. And, you know, they're very happy to see the dad because he's an army veteran. The dad is, very happy to see that the dog has been taught to salute because, of course, he's very much about, you know, the war effort being in the military. And, he's an older guy, so he probably fought in, I mean, I would assume Vietnam or Korea. I'm not sure what the timeline is for this particular book. But he's definitely up there in his at least 60s. I would say maybe even 70s or older. And so he's very happy about that. And, of course, he always makes jokes about his son because his son is kind of like a hippy-dippy type. Can't really keep a job, never really did anything with himself. You know, he was kind of an activist before the Martian attacks. So there's always like the play between the two. And I like that because it works really well, right? To show the difference in generations between these two characters, where one is very, I don't want to say gung-ho, but like very, very pro-country, very, about like family values and things like that and hard work. And the son isn't that. Right. And I think, you know, we do see that natural divide of generations. I think in particular now, maybe even more so with millennials, but, really interesting stuff. So they meet this group and they're like, well, if you want us to help you fight the aliens, they're coming this way. We need guns. And so they have like a spare old rifle that's a piece of crap and they give it to the dad and the son gets a knife because they don't want to give up their weapons. And he's like, well, you give me a knife. How am I going to fight the aliens? It's like, give me one of the guns on your back. Cause you know, they all have like 3 or 4 guns strapped to their backs and they're holding one. And he's like, oh no, you're not going to get my guns. These are my guns. And I find the whole thing really fascinating because I could totally see this happening in real life, right? Like if aliens come and you need to distribute arms, some people would be like, oh, well, you're not taking my weapons. You know what I mean? Anyways, the dad very soon realizes that these guys are a bunch of idiots and they're all going to get killed when the Martians come. And of course, the Martians do come. And of course, they do mostly get killed. But the way that they get killed is actually pretty funny because the aliens, it's almost like the aliens really know how much power they have, how much better they are than people. And so they kind of like kill people in weird ways. So at one point, one of the saucers brings out like a metal arm and just grabs a bunch of these guys and starts just tossing them up against buildings. And the dad's like, oh, now they're just playing with us. Or, you know, they can change their ray guns where, they can just like burn the skin off. So now all you have is like, you know, muscle or whatever. And they show that with the cows at the beginning of the issue. Or actually burn the flesh, right? So skin and muscle. And, like one guy, they shoot him in the leg. So, you know, he can't walk anywhere because he's got no leg muscles. And, anyway, it was pretty funny. It doesn't sound funny to have people have their muscles burnt off. But, when you see it in this comic, it's brilliant the way it's done. some guys get frozen, and yeah. Anyways, so the dad and son duo, like, get back in the wheelbarrow, they start going off, and dad's like, you gotta wait, we gotta save the dog. And the dog's about to get shot, and they cause a distraction that kind of gets the alien's attention off the dog and into them, and they shoot one of the aliens the cord that would, I guess, give him oxygen or whatever they breathe, and he starts dying so that way they can get the dog out. So now we have a trio going into the next issue, and the aliens are very mad because they almost killed one of their leaders. And that was kind of the end of the issue, but really, really fascinating stuff. This Mars Attacks is just really enjoyable. And, you know, I've read Mars Attacks comics before, but I think this one may be amongst the best Mars Attacks books that I've ever read. And, I just can't wait to get the next one. If you're not picking this up, like I said, I recommend you do. It's only two issues in. It's a mini series, so if you want to wait for the trade, wait for the trade. But I highly, highly recommend Mars Attacks from Dynamite. This is going to be a 5 out of 5. In fact, really strong week this week, I'm going to say. Probably one of the strongest weeks in quite a while. Let's go over to Marvel and talk about Web of Venom, Carnage Reborn. This is written by Donny Cates, art by Danilo Beirut, colors by Chris Peter, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And as you can imagine, this is about the return of Carnage, which we haven't seen in a while. I don't know what exactly happened to Carnage previously, because I haven't really been following a lot of the Spider-Man books and Spider-Man events. I do check them out every so often. I am reading the current one, the Web of whatever it's called, Spider-Geddon. And I really enjoy that kind of event. The Spider-Verse thing was one of my favorite things to come out of Spider-Man in quite a long time. So I'm glad to see the sequel to that event. But based on what I can gather in this book, and if you've read this, let me know exactly what it is that happened to Carnage on Twitter at Geekvine. You can email yell@comictalk.today. Presumably something happened and Carnage was sent into space and he died, I guess. I don't know. That's kind of what I gathered. But I was more interested in kind of this rebirth. So we get to reintroduce ourselves to Cletus Kasady, who of course the Carnage, and we learn about his birth, how terrible a birth he had, right? When he was born, he got choked into the umbilical cord and died, but he kind of woke up, I guess, after a couple of minutes. And then we learn about this terrible childhood he had, and how he always had these serial killer tendencies where he wanted to cut up people and skin them. And of course, if you're familiar with Carnage, you know Cletus is not a nice guy, right? He was a criminal. And so of course, when he got a symbiote, he became even crazier because now he had all this power to do things, whereas before he didn't, right? So we learn a little bit about that. We learn about him dying, being sent into space, and him coming back. And the way we learn about this story is through the Cult of Null. And this is actually really interesting. You know, if you listen to other podcasts, I talk about this in Nerd Legion, for example. I'm a big fan of cults. Not because I want to join a cult, because I find it fascinating the kind of things that people believe in and the way that they structure their lives around the beliefs that they somehow gather unto themselves. And this is true of, like, actual cults and then quote-unquote cults, right? Like, I don't know, people that believe in, like, aliens or whatever, right? It's really fascinating how people's minds work to shape the reality around them. And actually, that's something I want to talk about with Nick at some point, but not for this podcast. This is about comics. Anyway, so there's a Cult of Null, and they've kind of been trying to communicate with the Null. And if you're not reading Venom, then you might not know who the Null is, but Null is the symbiote god. So go check out Venom. I think it's like 8 issues in, 9 issues in. Really good. Also written by Donny Cates. I know it's been a little divisive for some people. I've really enjoyed this new take on Venom and the whole symbiote thing. And there's a lot of tie-ins to some of the stuff that we've seen before. Like when the leader of this cult is talking to the entire sect, they show, like, images. I don't know if they're not cave paintings or anything, or carvings. Maybe there are some kind of carvings that they got from somewhere. But they look kind of like simple, almost cave art, in like 3 or 4 different panels that show kind of the story of the Null. And Thor is in one of these panels, so I thought that was kind of cool to see, because there is a connection now between Thor and the Venom symbiote. And if you don't know what that is, go check out Venom and you will find out. As a matter of fact, I think I may have talked about this on a previous podcast. So maybe just go back and listen to all 120 previous episodes of the show. I don't know what episode it was. Maybe search for Venom and you'll find it there. But I thought that was really cool to bring this element in, because it does kind of go along with some of the symbiote god things that Donny Cates has introduced into the Venom book. And so part of the thing they want to do is communicate with the Null, right? Because he is their god, according to their philosophy. And so they devise this plan, and we learn a lot about Cletus and how he died and came back to Earth and how they found him, right? So it's this woman relating Cletus' story through, you know, the entire sect. And so as it turns out, when Cletus came back, his original symbiote suit, right, the red suit, kind of, he was so bonded with it, the suit protected itself and as a result wanted to protect Cletus and ended up dying as a result. But even through that, Cletus still somehow managed to be alive, although it seemed like maybe the impact of falling into Earth either killed him again or put him in a severe coma maybe. And some guys that are in the woods, they find Cletus's body. They turn into the authorities, who of course know who Cletus is because he's got millions of warrants out for his arrest. And they're taking his body to be studied in an armored car. The cult has some assassins that go in and kill the people in the armored car. They steal Cletus's body. They also somehow manage to steal a piece of a symbiote. And it's not a full symbiote, it's just a piece. But to them, that's all they need, because they know that when a symbiote implants itself into a host, the symbiote kind of always has a presence within that host DNA. And this kind of becomes important later on, and I'll get to that in a second. But, and so they want to use Cletus's body, because he has had a symbiote with him before, to communicate with the Null. And so they have him in this, like, weird contraption where all you see is his face. They insert the piece of symbiote inside. The symbiote takes over Cletus, and it becomes kind of like the Venom that we've seen in the Venom proper title, where it's just like the black suit with, I don't know, like weird white tendrils around his body, and then the spiral, red spiral on his face, because that is the Null. And as it turns out, Cletus has had such a connection with his symbiote. He is so strong-willed and so freaking crazy that he is able to overtake the mind of the symbiote god within his body and take control of that symbiote. And so you see the transformation of the symbiote from this black suit to the red suit, and it was freaking awesome. And of course, he's a killer, so the leader of the sect goes up to him, and she explains to him why he's here, why they did what they did, and he eats her, because that's what he does. And then tries to get some more information from some of the other cult members. Presumably, he just kills the entire cult. They don't show that, but I think we can assume at least a couple of people were killed as a result. And when he learns all this information that we've been related throughout the issue, he decides he's going to go and try to become like the ultimate symbiote and gain consciousness from all these different hosts that have worn a symbiote before. So you see him on the screen, and there's a bunch of different ones, right? Like Wolverine, Spider-Man, Commander General Ross, like a bunch of different people. And so it seems like maybe that's going to be Carnage's next mission. I don't know if that's going to be following this book, right? Another Web of Venom title, or if Carnage is getting a book. I haven't looked at the solicits, so I don't know if that's the case. But that'll be interesting to see how that plays out, in particular now that we have this whole new mythology with the symbiotes on the Venom proper book. So really, really enjoy this. I'm glad to see Carnage back. Carnage was kind of a two-bit villain back in the day, right? Very 90s, as we like to say. But I enjoyed actually Carnage a lot more than some of the other symbiote host things that were around the time. And I know since then there's been like a ton more introduced, like toxin, poison. There's like two dozen different ones, and they're all children of either Venom or Carnage, and interesting stuff. I plan on catching up on that stuff at some point, but there's just so much that whatever. I'm just happy to see Cletus back, and I definitely look forward to checking out Carnage's future adventures, because he is crazy AF, and I love it. let's move on over to a couple of Image books. I'll kick off with Exorcist Sisters number 2, written by Ian Boothby with art by Giselle Lagasse, colors by Pete Pantazis, and letters by Taylor Esposito. And this book is fantastic. I don't know if I talked about the first one. If I didn't, shame on me, because I should have. This book is really, really great. Really great. If you are familiar with Giselle's work, you may not be. She did some backup stories and covers for Die Kitty Die. That's Fernando de Reis is they do it like as a Kickstarter, and then Chapter House puts it out a few months later. Like after the backers get the books, Chapter House releases these in singles. I always get the Kickstarter because I like to get the hardcovers of them. But really good stuff. Go check out Die Kitty Die. Anyway, she's done work for those guys over there, and so that's the reason kind of I wanted to pick this up. And basically it centers around these two sisters. Should I spoil this? I'm going to spoil this. It's two sisters, spoiler alert, who aren't really sisters. They're actually the same person. And kind of follows their adventures. They are demon hunters, paranormal investigators, but they also have abilities. They're very familiar with witchcraft and demonology. And in this issue, really picks up the story quite a bit. So the first issue, we got the story about kind of what it is that they do, right? So we have this woman whose boyfriend was presumably killed, and now she's being possessed, or at least haunted by demons. And as it turns out, that's not really the case. The boyfriend made a deal with a demon in order to fake his death and make her really sad so the demon could feed off her sadness and he could get a bunch of money. This issue kind of picks up a little bit from the end of the first one where we meet Kate's mom. Kate is the main character. We meet Kate's mom at the end of the first issue. And in this second issue, we learn why it is that Kate's mom needs her help. I guess I'll just go with her help because they're the same person. Maybe I should say their help. I don't know. And we also learn why it is that Kate and her sister are not actually sisters and why they're the same person. It was hinted at in the first issue, but now we get the full story in this one. And it's really interesting because I think this story became a little bit darker, right? And because of Giselle's art, it does have that, like Archie type look. The storytelling is maybe a little Archie as well, but, of course, because we're dealing with witchcraft and demons, it's a little bit darker. But there is comedy and it's not, you know, like crazy darkness either, right? So as it turns out, Kate's mom had a lot of trouble when they were growing up. You know, she was married, she had a happy marriage, they had Kate. Kate was like a piano prodigy, and one day Kate's dad left, and the mom had never worked because he always provided for them, and she had a tough time finding work. Like, nobody would hire her, right? Not even like a clothing store, not even like McDonald's. Like, the manager would be like, oh, well, this is ideal for people with a first job. And she's like, this is my first job. And you know, this is a 30-something, maybe 40-something-year-old woman having her first job. And, you know, some of the people at the McDonald's or the burger place or whatever, they kind of snicker. And she's really down on her luck. And as she's walking around, she meets this guy. And, of course, you know, he's up to no good because he comes out from behind a dumpster in an alleyway. And that's never a good thing, right? It's either going to be a serial killer or a demon. And as it turns out, it's a demon. But he does give her a job, and the job is selling candles. And you're thinking to yourself, that's not really that big a deal. Well, these candles are demonic magical candles, and they grant wishes. And we learn a little bit about the types of wishes they grant and sometimes what the repercussions of these wishes are. So we see, that, for example, this one woman that buys one of these candles, and her wish ends up being to kill her wife. And so, you know, when the mom learns about this, she's like, well, crap, what the hell did I get myself into? And tries to get out of it. But, of course, she can't because she's working with demons. And so they send her soul to hell. In order to recover her soul, she ends up, I don't want to say inadvertently, because she definitely does it, but she sells Kate's soul to these demons. So this is the reason why Kate and her sister are two different people, even though they're the same person. So Kate kept on living without her soul, but as she learned the dark arts, part of the reason she did that is to regain her soul, I guess. And so she did go to hell. She managed to regain her soul, but by this point, they had become too different and too separate. And so she could not resume how would you say that? I don't know. Her soul could not go back into her own body. And so now they're two separate entities. And so now we know why they're the Exorcist sisters, even though they're the same person. And it has to do with her mom being a terrible person and selling her daughter's soul to the devil. Almost literally. And that's absolutely horrible. But as it turns out, the demon that she made a deal with, you know, now that Kate's soul is back on Earth and not in hell anymore and a different person, the demon feels like, hey, you broke your end of the deal because I don't have this soul anymore. We need to figure something out. I'm going to take your soul back. And of course the mom doesn't want that. So she's trying to get Kate and her quote unquote sister to help her. And she knows she's not really going to happen, right? And Kate wants nothing to do with her mom because of this whole situation. Right. I mean, it's her mom, so she loves her and she kind of sort of tolerates her. But I mean, her mom sold her soul to a demon. Quite literally, she had to go to hell to regain herself. And so she doesn't really want anything to do with it. She gives her mom a card and she's like, when you go to hell, just tear this card up. We'll come down there and help you. Maybe we'll get you out. Maybe not. But, have a good day. Leave us alone. And then we see that, you know, Kate's mom is being followed by a demon again. And, you know, she makes another deal with a demon to try to save herself once again. What a crappy person. God, what a crappy person. But the way this book is told, it's so brilliant. I absolutely adore this book. Check out Exorcist Sisters from Image Comics. Really, really fantastic. 5 out of 5. The first issue was also a 5 out of 5. I really loved it. Next Image book is going to be Middle West #1. And this is actually fascinating. Because I'm going to publicly say this on the show. I've said this, you know, privately to my friends. I'm not a big fan of Scotty Young. There's some things that I like Scotty in. He's doing, I believe he's the artist on United States vs. Murder, Inc., the Brian Michael Bendis book, and I really love that book. But when, I'm not a big fan of Scotty Young's stuff when he writes. Like, I like his art. I think his art's fantastic. But I'm not a huge fan of his written material. And I kind of enjoyed I Hate Fairyland, but when this came around, I was like, eh, do I want to pick this up? Do I not? And I was like, you know what? Whatever. I saw some preview pictures of it, and the art was gorgeous. And I was like, all right, I'll check this out just for the art. And I'm glad I did. I'm really glad I did. Written by Scotty Young, art by Jorge Corona, colors by Jean-Francois Boulou, and letters by Nate Picos. Yeah, Ronnie, let's hear you say Jean-Francois Boulou. Haha. Anyways, Middle West is really interesting. It is very much about a small town newspaper boy and his really crappy father. God, it must be like a theme this week. First we had a crappy mom, now we have a really crappy dad, and kind of the stuff that he has to go through. Except we learn that this place is not really, it's not middle America per se, right? It's not your typical small town. There's weird stuff going on in this town, and seemingly weird magical stuff going on. And it definitely has me intrigued to see what's going to be happening as the series progresses. This is an ongoing, by the way. It's not a mini-series. At least it's billed as an ongoing. So I'm sure we'll get, I assume, at least 8-12 issues. And I think that's probably good enough to flesh out the story that we were presented with in this one. Because there is really a lot to unpack. And I was really, really pleasantly surprised by how deep and emotional this book was. And how crappy, like, every character is. Like, every character in this book is really crappy. Maybe not Abel, the main character. He's still crappy. Alright, so let's talk about it. So Abel's a paperboy. And when the book opens up, he is fighting this, like, giant wind monster. And as it turns out, it's a dream, right? So he wakes up, and he's been dreaming about this giant wind monster. And, the dad's like, what the hell are you doing? Like, get up. You need to be delivering papers. And he's like hours late to delivering papers. So people are calling, complaining, threatening to cancel their newspaper subscriptions. And the dad's like throwing crap at him and like breaks his lamp. Like he's just abusive and terrible. And so, you know, he gets up, gets dressed and starts delivering newspapers. But he doesn't have much luck. Like as he's delivering, like the wind picks up and the newspapers get blown everywhere. He's like, crap. So he's trying to collect the papers. By the way, he's doing this with like a little fox. And, I can't tell if the fox is an imaginary friend or if it's actually a creature that's delivering papers with him because the fox can talk. But, you know, based on some of the other magical stuff that happens in this book at the beginning and the end, then maybe it's a real fox. I don't know. I can't tell. I guess we'll see in the next few issues. But it was cool to see anyways. And, it's almost got that, like, Wizard of Oz vibe, right? Cause it's almost set in, like, the same kind of place, right? Like, Kansas, Middle America, Dust Bowl, like, really windy tornadoes and stuff. Anyways, really cool to see. He's trying to collect the papers. His friends come by. So it becomes kind of like a friendship story as well. You know, they're all gonna go to their friend's house and play video games or maybe like a Dungeons and Dragons type game, it seems. And they want to stop at the store and get Hot Pockets. They're not called Hot Pockets, but Hot Pockets and something else. And the kid's like, you know what? Screw the newspapers. I'm gonna waste my time gathering them. They're all over the place. If anybody has a problem with it, they'll call my dad. He's gonna probably beat me anyway. So let's just go and have fun at least for a little while. So they go to the store, and as it turns out, they get caught shoplifting, which of course is not a good thing, but fortunately the shop owner doesn't have them arrested, he just calls their parents, and of course for most of them it's not that big a deal, but for Abel it is, because again, his dad is an abusive piece of crap, and so, you know, all the kids get picked up, and he is just there waiting for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. Finally dad comes up in the truck, picks him up, and takes him home. So they're about to go in the house, and dad's like, yeah, you're going to sleep right there. He's like, you want me to sleep outside? He's like, yeah, you're a big man, you're a shoplifter, you don't want to deal with the responsibilities of delivering newspapers. You can be a big man and sleep out in the grass. And so they start arguing, and the dad's, of course, getting meaner and meaner and meaner. And the kid's like, you know what, F you, like, this is the reason mom left you. And the dad turns around, and he's like, what did you say? And he's like, F you. And he hasn't repeated it a few times. He finally's like, F you. And the dad just smacks him in the face. He's like, you know what? Mom didn't leave because I'm an asshole. It's like, we had a great time. We loved each other. We were friends. We had fun all the time. And then you came along and she couldn't handle parenting. And that's why she left. She left because of you. And I was like, holy crap. Like, this guy was not already a piece of crap. Like, now he is triple the piece of crap telling his kid that his wife left because of him. But I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to the story because at this point, the dad turns into this giant wind monster that we saw at the beginning of the issue. And the kid's like, what the hell's happening? Why is my dad a giant wind monster? Starts running off with the fox. They get on this train and I guess the dad ends up going away. And we'll see what happens next. So like I said, there's a lot to unpack here. I'm not really sure how this world works. But I like the imagination that's being put into this kind of story. Being told, you know, it's almost like a comic veritas type thing, right? A slice of life. Ugh, I hate that term. But told through this like magical, fantastical story, very much like The Wizard of Oz. And I think that's just so fascinating. And it works really well in the story. And like I said previously, I mean, Jorge Corona's art, holy Jesus. Like, this is fantastic. If I ever publish a comic, I want Jorge Corona to be my artist. This guy is freaking brilliant. So, yeah. Middle West, number one from Image Comics. Definitely recommend you pick this up. Even if you're not a Scotty Young fan, because I'm not a Scotty Young fan, but this is just brilliant. 5 out of 5. Final book I'm going to talk about is American Carnage, number one from Vertigo Comics, written by Brian Edward Hill. I love Brian Edward Hill. Art by Leandro Fernandez. Absolutely fantastic art by Leandro Fernandez. Colors by Dean White, letters by Pat Brosseau, and covers by Ben Oliver. Fantastic cover. And usually I don't talk about cover artists because most comics have so many covers. But this American Carnage cover is really fantastic. I love Ben Oliver's work, so I wanted to highlight that. So this is not the typical type of book that Martin likes to read. But let me tell you, boy is it good. If you are a fan of Hot Lunch Special from Aftershock, a book that also came out last week, but I'm not talking about it because I do a Aftershock podcast, so we'll talk about it then. This is absolutely fantastic. It is a true crime, it's not noir, but it's true crime set in modern times. It follows, an FBI investigation of this, I don't want to call it alt-right group, but maybe that, it's kind of alt-right, kind of neo-Nazi, definitely neo-Nazi. There's a baby with a swastika blanket on it. But also has some other leanings in it. I don't know, man. It's very political. But when I say very political, I don't think it tries to present a particular viewpoint. but it's definitely in-your-face realism, because there's a lot of stuff in here that you can easily recognize from news events. And basically, it opens up with this FBI agent being questioned by the FBI based on a botched investigation slash raid, it seems. And she kind of tries to explain the story as best as she can, but it doesn't quite work out. We have a couple of, like, time shifts in this book. So we go back to the past and then back to the present. And she recruits this guy who used to be an FBI agent. We learn his story a little bit at the beginning of the issue as well. He was following a suspect, ended up shooting at the suspect, except it wasn't the suspect. It was a young black kid. And as a result, he was put on leave, seemingly permanent leave from the FBI. And the guy is mixed. He is half black, half white, but he looks white. And so as a result, they were kind of able to throw this investigation under the rug, even though he killed a black kid. But he was able to escape some of the political fallout because he's part black. And this book is definitely a lot about identity, racial identity, and what that means in America. So I think for people outside of the U.S., you may not catch some of the intricacies of this, but I think it was actually really fascinating. If you, what's the movie that just came out? Black Klansman. God, this reminds me a lot of Black Klansman. Except, you know, that story is based on a true story. This is not. And I think there's some, more interesting stuff going on here because of the main character being mixed race by looking white. Whereas in that movie, you have a black investigator posing as a white supremacist and then sending a white person to pretend to be him when he has to actually meet people face to face. Except that white guy is Jewish, so, you know, the Nazis also don't want him in their midst. But they don't know he's Jewish, right? Because he looks white. And I find that whole thing fascinating, right? Because we often place so much on race and ethnicity, but, you know, a lot of those lines are really blurred, right? So, I mean, I remember growing up, I grew up in New York, in the Bronx, and I remember, like, getting made fun of, or, like, kids trying to pick on me. It never worked, because I didn't give two shits, but, like, trying to pick on me, because where I lived, it was majority black, and so, being one of the lighter-skinned folks, you know, I get kicked like, hey, white boy, like this and that and the other. But then when I got to middle school and high school, I went to a private school. It was an all-white school, well, mostly white school. And by that, you know, at that point, I'm not like the whitest guy there. So they're like, oh, you know, the Spanish guy, or the Italian guy, or like this, that, and the other. And we see that a lot, right? I've seen this because of my Spanish family heritage, where somebody be like, oh, like, where's your family from? Be like, oh, you know, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, this, that, and the other. And after a while, you don't want to explain all those things, right? So you're like, oh, Italian and Spanish. Oh, Spanish, you don't look Mexican. Well, like, you know, not every Mexican, or not every Spanish person is Mexican, right? Every Mexican is Spanish, but not every Spanish person is Mexican. And that also kind of varies depending on where you are, right? So, like, in New York, there's a large Puerto Rican or Dominican minority. So, if you say Spanish, you're like, oh, you're Puerto Rican. Well, no, but okay. And I find that whole thing fascinating. And I'm assuming, again, I'm not black, so I don't know the exact experience, but I did grow up in a community that was majority African American, or black, really, because there was a lot of Jamaicans where I grew up. And the identity is kind of similar there as well, right? Because you have people of different color skins, a wide range of, you know, skin colors, and how even within that community you see different people treat each other differently based on the shade of the color of the skin. And this is kind of some of the stuff that's brought up in this book. And it's really fascinating to see, by the way. Obviously, Brian Edward Hill is a African-American writer, so he definitely has familiarity with some of the issues that are brought up in this book. But again, a lot of this is kind of ripped from headlines, right? And this group that's being investigated in the book is seemingly funded by a philanthropist. Now, that's the way that it's phrased. He's phrased as a philanthropist slash author slash podcaster. But it seems pretty obvious to me that his views are maybe not mainstream, because there's one point where a pastor in a black church invites him to speak at the church, and much of the congregation is like, why is this guy here, right? Like, he's kind of a racist. And he tries to explain maybe why he's not a racist, because, you know, everything's the government's fault. And I find that interesting, because we see that oftentimes in politics in particular, but with some of these groups that are trying to hide what they're really about, how they'll be like, oh yeah, it's not about, like, you know, whatever. It's because the band wants to keep us down. The government wants our guns, or, you know, whatever, right? And ultimately, it's just kind of like a scapegoat reaction or excuse. And this book plays with that a lot, right? And the things that he says kind of resonate with some of the black members of this church, and it doesn't with some others. And, you know, he kind of thanks the preacher. So this guy kind of gets convinced to infiltrate this group because he looks white. And so he goes to this presentation that this philanthropist is giving, and he's like, look, I'm a white guy, I'm down, like, you know. He doesn't say, like, the Mexicans took my job, but he kind of implies it, kind of one of those things. And he's like, yeah, I'm sure the organization can help you, like, meet with my daughter tomorrow, and you can discuss it. So he meets with the daughter at dinner, and, he, you know, he tries to use, like, the N-word, and she's like, oh, we don't like that word. Don't use that word. We don't believe in that word. And, like, she orders food in Spanish, and he's like, you speak Spanish? And she's like, yeah, we're in California. Of course I speak Spanish. And, but he tries to, like, constantly bring up, like, racial or ethnic slurs to see if she'll react some way to it. And she doesn't. And because, I mean, these people are very smart, right? But he keeps trying, and he kind of comes up with this whole backstory, how he's down on his luck, he needs, like, just help. And she agrees, so she invites him to a dinner at her father's house. And this is where he's going to meet this organization. And when he gets there, you know, it's a giant mansion, but they go into the backyard, and it's just full of the people that we saw in Mars Attacks number 2. Full of basically rednecks, right? People in just camel pants and wife beater shirts with their pit bulls and AK-47s and whatever. And if you're one of those people, like, I'm not picking on you, right? But that's what's in this book. And so we see that maybe there is a lot more going on in here, than we were initially led to believe when we met this guy. I thought it was really fantastic. Really, there's a lot of setup in this book, but I think overall the pacing is really well done, and so it fits the book very well. I think American Carnage may be my favorite of the Vertigo books to have come out. And I know that may be saying a lot sometimes, because I've really enjoyed a lot of these other ones, but I think this is just inches above Border Town right now. Border Town is absolutely fantastic. I think American Carnage, if the series continues, even just with the pace of this first issue, the entire run is going to be brilliant. So 5 out of 5 for American Carnage number 1. Really, really loved it. So pick this one up. And that's going to be it. That wraps up this episode of Top of the Pile. Thank you all for listening. I'll be back. I mean, there may be a second episode today. I don't know. But I'll be back tomorrow for sure. If you want to get in touch with me, Twitter is always the best place, at GeekVine. You can email yell@comictalk.today. I'm going to be doing a listener questions, listener feedback, whatever thing, at the end of the week. So if you want to send me questions or anything that you want me to discuss on that particular episode, please do. I have a collection of about like half a dozen right now that I've put together, so there'll definitely be content, but I want more, so feel free to send me your questions. That's going to be it. Catch you on the next one.